BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre, right near Queen Square, where we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to you in Bristol, and also to our listeners in Preston, and those all over the world, including South America. We have two studio guests this week, Keith Donoghue and Jackson Moulding. Keith is the town clerk of Wells and Somerset, and he's here to tell us all about his job. He originally sang as a chorister with the Savoy Chapel in London many years ago, and then became the town clerk of Wells. Jackson Moulding is from Ecomotive, an organisation that helps people with self-build projects, and he will be focusing on the Ashley Vale project in St Werburgh's in Bristol. We have a feature from Anthea Page, an interview with Peter Dobbins at the church in Oust. Malcolm Greaves reads the first instalment of our new serial, The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill, which is set in Oxfordshire between 1920 and 1930. And Jeff Sparks rounds up the show with his latest What's On. I'm John Peters Coleman, and now for a new sting on swine flu. You may have noticed one thing about this week's swine flu outbreak, that none of the experts and commentators have questioned the hypothesis that this is a natural outbreak. Well, what does that mean? Well, more and more ordinary people are asking the question, is this some sort of leak of a man-made agent, and has it been genetically engineered? Talk show host Alex Jones in Texas is well known for his anti-government views in the US, and he managed to find an expert with a very different and unique viewpoint. Vaccines expert Dr. Sherry Tenpenny works down in Mexico. She's also the author of Foul, Bird Flu, It's Not What You Think, Foul, examines the spectre of mandatory vaccination, and exposes how pharmaceutical companies, chemical companies and agribusiness are not separate industries, but function more as sister enterprises working together for mutual benefit, profit and power. Good Lord, what a load of conspiracy theories we have for you this week. So let's find out more about those.
In 2005 and 2006, I went to the first, second, and third national bird flu summits held in Washington, D.C. to get firsthand information, take my own notes, and to correlate it with what I had put in my book, Foul. And they were saying then, this is not a matter of if, it's when. It's when this is going to happen. They were saying it point-blank language. I actually wrote several articles about it on the Internet. So they've known this was coming. They've known this is coming. And they and I can't say that it's because they were just sort of doing it based on epidemiological or statistics. I mean, they're privy to stuff that you and I will never know. And for them to be so bold and to continue to train FEMA, Homeland Security, local departments, having vaccination drills around the country. I mean, this has been planned and in the works at least since 2005 and God knows how long before that.
And Dr. Tenpenny, medical doctor reporting to us from Monterrey, Mexico, are you saying that the available evidence shows that this is leaning towards a genetically engineered virus, or is this just them hyping a convenient virus for something they know they're going to release in the future?
I think it's too early to say. I do think that there's going to be something that's going to be released, or it's going to be shown that there's this is a really unusual virus. The evidence of saying it's swine, bird flu, and human. Now, they just had a report down here just not too long ago, maybe in the last couple of hours, saying that's kind of ridiculous. This is just an aggressive human virus. It's silly to be calling it swine flu, and I have to agree with that. And so I think that there's a lot of hype that's going on, a lot of hysteria. It never ceases to amaze me.
Exactly. I mean, there are hundreds a day dying of TB alone in Mexico City and the common cold. So why are they hyping it now?
Alex, the U.S. government in 2005 invested $7.1 billion into new vaccine development. So maybe this was a return on investment.
This is about BioShield. This is about BioShield.
With BioShield, we've got to start using all those vaccines that we just put into place. And Division E, remember Division E that came out at the end of 2006? It was tacked on at the end of the defense appropriation bill that basically says that all they have to do is whisper that this may be bioterrorism, and they and the pharmaceutical companies have 100% protection and liability for any drug, any vaccine, anything that comes out to be used against.
So this is about an industry that literally bankrolls the government and the media with campaign contributions and advertisement. Half the nightly news ads are drug ads. This is just about more of their fear-mongering to then sell everybody getting 2, 3, 4 deadly flu shots a year that actually debilitate your immune system and in many cases give you the flu.
And also use Tamiflu. Now, Tamiflu, I documented in the book that the more you use Tamiflu, the more resistance the viruses come. That by the fourth dose of Tamiflu, a garden variety influenza virus can be up to 10 million times more resistant to Tamiflu than it was before it was exposed to the drug.
So it's making them resistant just like bacteria with antibiotics.
Exactly.
Vaccines expert Dr. Sherry Tenpenny there talking to Texas talk show host Alex Jones and offering presumably a lot of food for thought, especially as we read more and more and more scare stories in the papers in the coming weeks. You can hear more from Alex Jones on the web at Infowars.com, info as in information, Infowars.com and PrisonPlanet.com, as well as on the Genesis Communications Network at www.gcnlive.com. She's also the author of Foul Bird Flu, It's Not What You Think. Fowl examines the spectre of mandatory vaccination, and her website is www.drtenpenny.com.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Welcome now to Keith Donoghue, who is the town clerk of Wells in Somerset. Hello.
Hello.
How on earth did you do you go about finding out about a job as a town clerk? And what is a town clerk?
When I find out, please let me know. I as you said at the beginning, I was a singer. I'm also a lawyer. My singing enthusiasm took me to Wells to sing in the cathedral choir there in 1982. And I worked as a lawyer in private practice. And saw the job of town clerk advertised in the local paper and thought, that sounds interesting.
Yeah.
Applied. I hadn't a clue what the job involved, but I knew that it was basically sort of legal and sort of to do with local government. And was a bit surprised when I got offered the job.
Right.
So I went along and thought, where do we go from here? I don't think I'd actually ever met a politician in my life before, face to face. So that was quite a sharp learning curve.
But you originally trained as a lawyer, though. Is
yes.
That right? How long did you train as a lawyer for?
Oh, a long time. That's what brought me to Bristol.
Right.
I came to what was then Bristol Poly at Ashley Down to the law school.
Yeah.
Did my training there, then I went and worked for the AA, the Automobile Association, not Alcoholics Anonymous,
right.
As a legal advisor.
Yeah.
Then I worked for Bath City Council, and then I got the job in private practice. So I had a sort of varied career.
What was the interview like? I mean, you say you didn't really know anything about what it was to be a town clerk. What was you went along and...
Well, they asked. I mean, obviously, I did some research and I found out what the council did, which, to be honest, in those days wasn't an awful lot. It's a council. It has lots of buildings that it runs. It used to give out grants, but it wasn't a particularly active council.
Right.
And so they asked me questions about what I'd done and how I would run the council, and presumably I gave the right answers.
Okay.
And as I say, hit the ground running, really. And the job has evolved over the last 15 years and is now very interesting, because what central government want to do, they think that local councils are quite sexy organisations, and they want to devolve as much as possible to them.
Local councils and the word sexy is...
No, I know. It doesn't often go together.
No.
but, they basically want local people running as much locally as is possible. And that's the sort of buzz thing at the moment, and it's certainly something that I'm quite passionate about.
John Prescott has been plugging this for donkey's years before, he's kind of moved out of the limelight a bit now.
He has moved out of the limelight, and now it's... The somewhat feisty Hazel Blears, who's taken up the mantle.
Right.
And the problem is, there are lots of mixed messages. So different organisations in central government are on different messages. But I mean, I do quite a lot nationally, and one of my jobs is to keep sort of waving the flag and saying, remember, you think we're important. We're getting there.
What do you think are the main advantages of you being a town clerk, helping to a local council to run more things locally as opposed to things being run centrally?
Well, I think you can refer... I mean, at the moment, we're setting up the fun fair in Wales. It comes in twice a year.
Okay.
And we took that over about 5 or 6 years ago. And the argument for us doing it was twofold. One is it's on our doorstep, so we know what the issues are.
Yeah.
And the other is we know what people want, or we can find out what people want.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we can get rides that actually people want there and are going to use, rather than what was happening before, which was somebody had no connection with Wells, but giving a contract to an operator and having no involvement with what was going on. That's, it sounds like a silly example,
yeah,
but it is actually the thrust of what
it provides a good example.
Local councils can be all about.
Yeah.
They can find out what people want, and they can then deliver the goods on the basis of what the local community says its expectations are.
Okay, so it's your first day as your town clerk. What are your sort of list of everyday duties? What are you actually doing sort of most days of the week?
Well, we own a lot of buildings. We get about 50% of our income from property rents. So there's a certain amount of management of that to do. There's all the boring stuff of agendas and minutes of meetings and making sure that you comply with the law. There's finance, there's planning, we run the cemetery, we run the public toilets, we deal with wobbly paving stones,
right,
dirty road signs,
yeah,
lamp standers that aren't lit. So, you know, it's whatever comes in through the door on that day, really.
But you found that a town clerk is now encompassing a lot more than he was, say, 15
yeah,
years ago.
Yeah, started. I mean, the job has evolved, and I suppose it's like all things, I enjoy doing it. And if you get involved, you get more things, more jobs.
Tell me a little bit. I understand that for some reason your name is on the credits of Hot Fuzz. Tell me a little bit about how a town clerk come to do that.
I had a call from a location manager who said, we want to come and make a film in your city, and we're going to take it over for 12 weeks. And I said, that's going to cause a few problems.
Okay.
They said, what we'd like to do is have a public meeting, and we'll tell the public about what the stresses and strains are going to be. Will you chair it? So I said, yeah, okay. So I chaired this meeting in the town hall, and it sort of evolved that we were talking about really quite a big film here.
Mm.
And I didn't know at the time that I had the two stars sitting either side of me.
Oh, right.
Terms of Simon Pegg and Nick Frost.
Yeah.
But they took over Wells for the better part of 12 weeks. And my job was really just to fix all the issues that arose. One evening they wanted to do a shoot in the marketplace and found that everybody had put their trade refuse out in bright orange bags, which wasn't exactly what they wanted.
Mm.
So we had to summon up a van and collect all the rubbish and sling it around
were
the back of the town hall.
Relatively welcoming of them, or
To begin with, they were. It began to pale after a while.
Really?
It got a bit tedious. And I mean, the entertaining things were the little old lady who came into my office in a state of great excitement and said, "It's tremendous. We're going to have a greengrocer's up this end of the town." And I had to point out that the window was actually full of plastic cauliflowers and it wasn't a real shop. So it was good fun.
What were the sort of issues that sort of began to pale near the end? Is it just, were they...
Well, the great British public are sort of creatures of habit, and they want to get from A to B on the route that they've always used.
Yeah.
And if they find a film crew in the way,
even if
they're held up for no more than 5 minutes, they do tend to get a bit ratty. So after 12 weeks, it was beginning to pale just a little bit. But the bottom line is, we got the most incredible credit out of it. Everybody who's seen the film knows it was filmed in Wells.
As a sort of intermediary then, perhaps, between more centralised government and the local people, what sort of contact do you get with politicians, and what do you make of them now compared to what you thought of them before you became town clerk?
I think that I do a lot of work with other clerks, and what I've said is that you could train a monkey to write an agenda or do the minutes.
Yeah.
The real challenge is the psychology of politics, and I don't understand it.
Right.
But I do know that that good local government officers are people who try to understand what makes politicians tick and work with them. It doesn't always work, and it isn't always easy, but that's my take on it.
But sort of the general feel, it sounds like, is that you're a sort of an official that the people of Wales can trust as a sort of intermediary between them and the greater politics in Westminster.
I hope so. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion in Somerset about unitary councils, and they decided not to have a unitary council in Somerset. So we've got three tiers of government. There's us, the district, the county, and then whatever comes down from central government. So it's not straightforward. And I see my role as to be a focal point for people in Wales to deal with their issues.
Yeah. Do you get much contact with other sort of town clerks AGM of?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Other
I do.
Town clerks, yeah.
I do a lot in the southwest with other clerks and a lot nationally, so I know what's going on.
Okay. What do you see as the sort of the future for your position? You've seen it develop and evolve a lot. You're a lot more involved now. What do you think that could develop even more?
Yeah, it will vary from place to place. I don't see it changing dramatically in Wales, but I think nationally it could be quite a significant time for local councils.
So you're flying the flag for devolvement?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Keith, and I wish you all the best.
It's a pleasure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
We've been featuring Gaza, and in particular the Gaza convoy, in previous programmes of Dialects, particularly Mohammed Al-Haddad. We hear a song now from the Red Notes Choir, based in St. Weibergs. The Red Notes Choir campaigns for peace, justice, freedom and internationalism, and was first formed in 2002. This song is called Biladi. It's a song in Arabic, which reflects the tragedy of occupation and the loss of the homeland suffered by the Palestinian people. Quotes, "My land, my land, my land, for you is my love and my heart." That was the Red Notes Choir singing Biladi, or Biladi, excuse my pronunciation if that's wrong. Our next guest here in the studio is Jackson Moulding from the organisation Ecomotive. He's going to talk about a self-build project in St. Werburgh's. Bristol locals might have spotted some odd-looking houses around the area. Now is your chance to find out more. It's called the Ashley Vale Project. Hello, Jackson.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thank you. Tucked away at the far end of a railway tunnel at the end of a cul-de-sac is one of Bristol's best-kept secrets. The Farm Pub and St. Werburgh's City Farm, plus one of Bristol's biggest allotments, make this one of the most sought-after places to live in the city. It's not really on the way to anywhere, unless you're cycling about, but it's one of the most innovative urban housing projects that the city has ever seen. Ashley Vale has been put together by ordinary people and is fast becoming a centre of excellence for urban housing, design and self-build. How did the Ashley Vale site first come about and happen, and what is your involvement in it?
Well, the site was originally a scaffolding yard that was nestled in, as you state, in this part of Bristol, surrounded by allotments. And it's a dead end street down there, so there's no sort of through traffic. And the site came up, obviously, for sale. And many of the local people got together to try and do something else with it rather than let it just go to a normal housing developer and be developed along those sort of routes. And because of the price of the land, the only real option was to create more housing on it. And there's a couple of guys who'd already built a self-built house nearby, and it kind of evolved into the idea that we could set up the opportunities for people to build their own homes as a way of having an affordable place to live.
Are you Werburgh's or Werb's local yourself?
Yeah, I've been living there for 10 years. I lived just down the road. I was renting a room in a just a house, one of the terrace houses nearby, and there was no way I could afford to get a house in Bristol. But this potentially was an opportunity that I could build my own home, and it would fit within the sort of budget that I could afford.
Right, I'm looking at a little picture postcard of what it looks like at the moment, and it does look very impressive, and all the houses look sort of quite different. How many people are sort of involved in this project? Because it looks quite big.
Well, originally it was set up by, I guess, a collection of about 10 local people that set up the Ashley Vale Action Group to try and buy the land. They went through a whole process of planning for real and feasibility studies to try and see whether it would be possible and whether there'd be enough interest in people wanting to build their own home. And the amount of interest was amazing. And so that sort of evolved to the point where we set up the opportunity for 20 self-built plots that went round the outside. That's sort of resulted in about 30 homes on the site. The centre of the site was going to be developed by a housing association. In the end, the Asheville Action Group took that site back because there's problems with the housing association, which has resulted in us building 6 self-finished units, which may be more appealing for people that don't want to do a whole build themselves, which allowed people to come in and do all the internal works, but the fabric of the building was built to high sustainability standards.
So there's varying standards to which, if you're interested in self-build, you can interact with the building of the home to perhaps your own personal sort of idea.
Exactly, yeah. I think self-build is a very broad term that we use, and it includes self-finished. You can be involved from designing your place, and that's about it, or you can actually be involved at project managing it, or actually sort of banging the nails in and cutting the bits of wood up and putting them up.
So as much as you feel you have the confidence to do, you can sort of get stuck right in there and have some personal pride in having created your own home.
Yeah, and it's an amazing way of being involved in your own space that you've been able to build, and you end up with a space that someone else hasn't built because they're trying to build within the scenario where they're producing finance back to for their shareholders. It's actually the design of the space is for what you want.
Onto Ecomotive as an organisation, what is broadly the purpose of Ecomotive and what is the idea behind it?
Well, we set up Ecomotive as an offshoot from the Ashley Vale Action Group project, whereby the Ashley Vale Action Group was solely for looking at the land in that area, whereas Ecomotive is now looking at how can we replicate some of the good things that we've found in doing the self-build project in St. Werburgh's to give the same opportunities to people across the southwest and across the UK.
Because particularly in Devon, there's been a lot of attention to new build towns across Devon to try and house the sort of increasing population. So presumably, this is an ideal time to try and expand as much as possible.
Yeah, well, it's an amazing time, really, for people that want to do a self-build project, because the land prices are dropping. The large developers aren't building as much as they could be building and they're able to build, is a very difficult time for the big developers. And the current housing situation is really critical at the moment. I think there's 160,000 people in the southwest that are on social housing waiting lists. You know, there's a really big challenge for housing associations to provide homes for those people and for local authorities to provide homes. Then you've got all the people that don't fit that, you know, the niche of actually being able to get social housing, that maybe, you know, have got low incomes or struggling to, you know, keep their jobs with this current economic climate. So
in terms of sort of hard currency then, I mean, what sort of costs are we looking at if you want to get involved, if you're interested in thinking, well, this sounds up my street?
Well, the problem is, you know, is the land price and getting hold of land. And as I said, you know, land prices are dropping, but it's still very tricky being able to get hold of the land. If you're able to get a piece of land, then you can build anywhere between, you know, £3,000 up to £100,000 for a really good, you know, sort of a nice home. You know, the £3,000 is for a very simple low impact dwelling. But yeah, you know, you could build for £50,000 a really nice sustainable home that's going to have really low fuel bills. You know, keep you in a nice space.
Tell me a little bit about sustainability in terms of the eco-friendliness of the house. I mean,
what, self-built housing?
Yeah.
Well, sustainability is a strange term, isn't it? I think everyone's ideas of sustainability are very different. I think in this current economic climate, I think a sustainable home is something you can afford to stay in. I think, you know, putting a more of a sort of environmental sort of focus on it, then it's, you know, having a house that has a sort of a lower impact on the environment through its carbon emissions and its the amount of energy it uses. So, you know, sustainability is also about having a space that you're happy to be in and that you can grow within, you know, your family or your setup, you know, within maybe the local surrounds, and that you're not needing to sort of fly off to kind of escape the space that you live in.
What sort of environmental concerns have you thought about, and executed, if you like, what concerns have you put into these houses? What ways are they sort of environmentally friendly?
Well, the project in St. Werburgh's has sort of developed over the different phases. The first phase was the self-build. The second phase, as I said, was the self-finish elements. And the third phase, which we're working on at the moment, is six self-finish renovation units in a large office building that remained on site that the scaffold company used to use. Now, each phase has involved different levels of sustainable technologies and design, through from passive solar and using solar thermal panels to provide hot water. And we've also put solar photovoltaic panels on a lot of the roofs.
Okay.
They're very expensive, but they do provide an element of electricity to offset your electricity supply. But you know, the most important thing is making them energy efficient in terms of the insulation thicknesses in the walls and making them airtight.
Are you getting any favourable behaviour when you're trying to sort of find finance for them or getting sort of planning permission? What do you feel is the sort of the reaction to these sort of supporting sustainable lifestyles? Are you finding a lot of support for it?
Well, I think sustainability is becoming, or sustainable lifestyles is becoming, much more on people's agenda. You know, the end of each winter, I think people suddenly realise how big their gas bill is and sort of struggling with trying to pay that off. And if there's a way that you know, we could all live in homes where we weren't burning gas for you know, during a nice hot summer's day, and then it seems that's a bit daft. But I think if there's the support has been fairly, you know, I think self-build is still quite new in terms of the large authorities and large organisations in recognising it, even though self-build delivers about 20,000 homes per year. We've been talking with the Homes and Communities Agency and the communities local government, and I think there's quite a strong interest in trying to use self-build and self-finish as a way of addressing the collapse in the construction industry in terms of providing jobs for, you know, construction jobs and developing skills for, you know, all the people that work in that, you know, work in that industry at the moment that may be losing their jobs because the big developers aren't doing anything.
Can people sort of visit and sort of go in the Ashley Vale sort of area to have a look around any of the homes, sort of?
Yeah, of course. You know, people can come and visit the site. It's all open. It's near the, it's right near the St. Werburgh City Farm. There's a little cafe there, so it's, you know, it's really lovely on a weekend. Bring your kids. There's, you can come and see the pigs and the goats and the sheep. And there's a nice walk up over the hill that looks over Bristol, just up behind as well. So
okay, yeah. The only other place I'm thinking people may have an idea about what Ecomotive is about. What about the Bristol Eco Home at the Create Centre? Have you seen that? What was your reaction to that? If you've seen it?
Yeah, no, it's great. I think any project where there's a demonstration of the type of techniques and technologies that can be used in making a lower impact home is brilliant. It's just a shame that there's no one actually living in that unit. You know, the need for housing. I think we need to, you know, do as much as we can.
Do you have any hope for the current year that you can expand into any other areas outside Ashley Vale?
Yeah, well, we're trying to raise as much interest. So if anyone is interested in building their own home, then have a look at the Ecomotive website.
Okay.
And join on to the forum. And the more people that get involved now, we can try and influence maybe developers to pass on a bit of land, or maybe local authority to provide some land that we can try and do some more projects.
Okay. You can find Jackson and Ecomotive on the web, www.ecomotive.org. Jackson Moulding, I wish you very, very best of luck for the future. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
This seems as splendid a juncture as any to briefly mention a charity thing. That's what we do well at Community Radio. 125, which is an organisation that looks after the interests of women, vulnerable women no less, who work as prostitutes, that we have interviewed before, and they'll be coming on again, are organising a night walk on the 13th of June at the Ark, which is on Cotton Road South in Bristol. Night Walk 2009 will be a night to remember, as people take to the Bristol streets in fancy dress and raise money for some of the city's most vulnerable women. The walk is based on a figure of eight circuit around some of Bristol's most iconic sites. And you can either choose to walk the 5-mile challenge or the full 10-mile challenge in whatever costume you please. You can enter as an individual or be placed in a team. I won't read out the whole thing because I'm not sure we have time to read the whole leaflet, but if you want to find out more, www.justgiving.com/125nightwalk. Just to confuse issues, 125 Nightwalk is spelled O-N-E for one, the number two and the number five, Nightwalk. Or you can visit their own website, www.125.org.uk. That's, once again, O-N-E-25.org.uk.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
It's now time for the very first instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary, our new serial. Those of you who've been enjoying the honeyed tones of Malcolm Greaves, professional actor who's read Laurie Lee and History of the Mafia, well, here is his new story to read, a story set in Oxfordshire between 1920 and 1930. In 1922, out of the need to earn a living, Mr. John Fothergill moved with his family to Tame in Oxfordshire to run this Spread Eagle Inn. The people and customs he came across were not quite what he was expecting or used to, so he wrote about his experiences in a diary. The intro music to this, a tune called Old Molly Oxford, was performed by some musicians in the famous Royal Naval Volunteer Pub in King Street, Bristol, who meet every Tuesday for an impromptu music session. Take it away, Malcolm.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. 1922. I imagine that everyone who has had a career of any character has his amicological tree, to the root of which he can trace his chief relationships and interests, his good or ill in life. My tree grew out of Robert Ross, Amicus Amicorum, and its two main branches were my friendships with E.P. Warren and 12 years Greek archaeological study in surroundings, and with Will Rothenstein, his family and friends, Tonks and Steer and so forth, Will, whom I have watched inventing innumerable geniuses, helping and fighting for them and with them, and getting in return different treatments at different times. This, then, with Westmoreland blood, the most precious in England, has been the main source of what I have to give as an innkeeper, and even that is far from enough. But it was more than enough to disqualify me for any of the usual jobs when, in 1922, I found that I must do something for a living, so I was compelled to take an inn. Here at least I thought I might still be myself and give to others some of what I had acquired before making this clean-cut departure from the past. There are always plenty of inns to be had, as many as houses and as inaccurately described by the agents. I looked at a great number, but all of them had clientels and traditions, or definite trades or attractions, which were not my traditions, attractions, etc. At last, seeing this place advertised, I got my dear friends Monty and Lady Pollock to go and vet it. Lady Pollock wrote, "Very shabby, but very possible." And I thought I saw my chance of running a most splendid farmer's pandemonium in this almost unknown patch of rural England. A ceremony of changeover was a lurid proceeding. After the signing of the deeds and the handing over of the money, in cash, I and the two, in this case, preceding proprietors, the last one had held this little gold mine for only a year, our respective brokers, solicitors and valuers ate a coarse, silent lunch together, after which each of them put a pound note into a plate, and for the new proprietor's wife, which time-honoured act of generosity was followed later by the vendor's valuer telling me that he had omitted in his valuation the price of a coconut mat in the hall, about which nothing need be said now. The valuation of the furniture, agreed by our two valuers, was £1,400. Some weeks afterwards I sold it all, save the knives and forks and the very common crockery, for £85 at public auction, and brought in my own on the following day. Besides the almost total loss on the furniture, the selling of it lands me in a predicament because, when I should want to retire, I must either sell or try to sell my own furniture at its proper value, which no innkeeper would give me, or sell it empty, which would be as difficult, or refurnish at great expense. No wonder under these conditions the poor innkeeper has to stick to his beastly sticks, and the hard beds that pitch as well as toss and roll. On the first day I gave it out, as I had been advised, that there would be free drinks in the evening, and we were filled to the doors and emptied, like my dear friend John Marshall's sister Pro, who, he said, had such a big voice that she could fill St. George's Hall and empty it. No owner of a licensed house could ever feel, of course, that his house was his own, but I think this particular public house must have been exceptionally public. Not only indoors, but in the yard and garden, people wandered at will, each for his own little secret business, or with his own particular time-honoured privilege or abuse. One old farmer had to have his market day dinner for 1 and 6 pence at the end of the kitchen table, as he was often sick on the floor. In the billiard room, they played little, but many didn't pay. The billiard table was a curious one. Some 30 years before, the then proprietor had watched in silence some yokels play 100 up in about 1.5 hours for 1 shilling, when he burst into a pleasant stream of frightful oaths and said he'd have in future an innkeeper's billiard table, which soon arrived, hollowed out towards the pockets. Thenceforward, the locals played quicker and better, and all were pleased. Proceeding slowly up the yard, I'd watched every Tuesday evening for almost 2 years what looked like a man carrying his own cross before him, and then returning with another, for a friend perhaps, and disappearing into the coach-house. Later he would go up again with a barrel full of timber, until I was brave enough to ask what all this gear was. "Oh, my fish stall. I store it here during the week, you see." When we'd been here a day or two, Kate, my wife, wandered into the garden with Michael, aged 3, to explore it. At the end, under the trees, one of them a huge walnut, for which the High Wycombe Seekers of Queen Anne Furniture used to offer me rich sums up to £6, they found an old shed with a green thatch in holes. They pushed the door open and peeped inside, and in the dark corner near the door they saw crouching a man with an evil black and white face, and a sack standing in front of him. Kate withdrew the child, talking cheerfully, and came to me. I collected the degenerate gardener, who was, for once, luckily, on the premises, and to my surprise the horrible-looking fellow was still there. I pulled him out and found that he'd merely been stealing a sack full of our walnuts. I rained all the worst curses I could invent upon him, under which he began to grow restless. He put his hand to his hip pocket. "Look out, sir," said the gardener, half aloud. "He carries a pistol," at which I quickly dried up and told him to get back over the wall. I discovered later that he was a harmless pilferer and, of course, I never carried a pistol. At that time, the classical joke in this town was schoolmaster.
"Where do knives come from?"
Scholar. "Please, sir, the spread eagle." We used to sell beer in casks to the farmers, but they lost so many of our casks that in the end we gave it up, having to pay £40 to Messrs. Eind Coop, which, but for the kind intervention of their Mr. T.R. Tame, would have been £80. The inn was always empty, save on Tuesdays, when 100 farmers and kindred trades overran the place, literally from top to bottom. We were not in it, but the dirt and noise was. We were frightened to death. After 4 or 5 weeks, I noticed that the girl in the bar was selling cigars in wine glasses, pretty freely, so I made up my mind timidly to ask her where she got them from. "In a cupboard in the nursery," when I found the door to a recessed hole in a dark passage wall, covered like the rest with oak-grained wallpaper. I now braced myself to ask her for the key, which she haughtily gave me, and I found some 5,000 cheap cigars being dried to tinder, because the cupboard overhung the hot kitchen below. I was told I mustn't decline drinks offered me, but that I should keep the innkeeper's bottle, containing a harmless coloured drink. I didn't do this, but one day the late 80-year-old Captain Howland, late quartermaster Oxford Yeomanry, courteous and tactful old thing, asked me to have one. So, along with his gin and water on a tray, I brought myself a glass of cold water, for the drinking of which he gave me 9p. Here they used to keep an eagle, Aquila spuria, in a sort of meat safe in the backyard, which apparently amused the sort of people who came here, because we get inquiries for it even now. Fortunately, it died just before we got here, teased to death by a Sharaban crowd.
Thank you very much to Malcolm, and you can hear part two of The Innkeeper's Diary next week. Our next feature is from Anthea Page. It's an interview with Peter Dobbins from the church in Aust, AUST, which hosts monthly concerts of early English music. But first, you're going to hear some early music, The Oxford Waits. Now we know where mobile ringtones originated. A little bit about the Oxford Waits. They were first mentioned in 1501, and that's Waits, spelt as in W-A-I-T-S, and they may have existed in the Middle Ages. Waits was a medieval name for an official musician, and payments to them were first recorded in 1574. There were usually 6 of them, and they were usually expected to perform on public holidays and at civic occasions. A special gallery was built on the east side of Carfax Conduit for them to play on during royal visits. By 1613, the Waits had the sole permission to perform in the city and in the suburbs, and a new appointment could only be made from apprentices or freemen musicians. In 1673, the Waits were below strength and the qualification was wavered, and the council agreed to supply the Waits with new liveries and badges and uphold their sole performance rights. In the late 17th century, many city Waits also kept alehouses, and new cloaks were provided by the council up to the year 1712, but after this date, no reference to the Oxford Waits has been found since.
I'm Peter Dobbins, and I, with my wife Gina, we run Music in the Church at Aust, which is a series of monthly concerts presenting early music, medieval music and traditional music from throughout the world in the little parish church in Aust.
How did you get started? What gave you the idea?
Well, back in the middle of the 1990s, this church was in a terrible state, and the village sort of got together and we had a big restoration programme to put a new roof on and all sorts of other things. And got some big grants from English Heritage and places like that, but we still had to raise a lot of money ourselves. So we thought it might be a good idea to put on a few concerts of music that seemed appropriate in the building to see if they would raise some money, and It didn't actually make a lot, but we enjoyed it and we've just carried on ever since.
Can you tell us about the sort of music?
Right, well, we do historical music, mostly medieval, some of it sort of Renaissance and even later into the Baroque. And we do traditional music, and that's from anywhere through Europe. So we can have English folk songs and French folk songs and German folk songs, whatever. And the artists we have are pretty well sort of world-renowned, some of them. And for instance, this year we are having, for example, John Tamms, who was one of the folk heroes of the 60s and is still well known for his songs in the Sharp television series and various other things.
So do a lot of these singers, do they actually research old songs?
They do, yes. And we very often have programmes that are special for us. The one we're having tonight with the Oxford Waits that they put together just for this one concert. And they've researched all the material and so on.
Can you tell us about that? Because it's quite an interesting concert, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it's about this Earl of Rochester, John Wilmot, who I hadn't heard of before, but apparently he was quite a close buddy of Charles II, and he wrote an awful lot of poetry, not the sort of poetry you'd want to read to your children. I looked some of it up.
A bit bawdy, then.
Bawdy, yes. I haven't found one yet without at least a couple of words you wouldn't want to use in church. And he was apparently a very wild character, but he did write lots of poetry, which is a good thing, I suppose, and on his deathbed he renounced it all and declared himself a good Christian, so he probably went to heaven as well.
It'll be poetry tonight and singing, won't it?
That there'll be sort of some storytelling and readings from the time, plus music. The band play 17th century music on 17th century instruments. Lots of stuff that you may have heard before. The sort of thing that's very often played at barn dances comes from that sort of period. A lot of it was collected by a guy called John Playford, 1650-something, and they'll be playing a lot of his tunes and a lot of stuff from broadsheets, which is the way music was sold in those days. People used to print it on sheets and sell it in the street, and they'll be singing some of those songs as well.
Is it hard to find people who have an interest in early music?
Well, it's somewhat esoteric. There aren't many people that do it, which is why we do get quite large audiences from far and wide, you know, from Bath and Bristol and Gloucester and way beyond. We've had people here from Edinburgh before now. But the music is kind of thriving, and there are an awful lot of bands and artists doing that sort of music, and really our problem is not finding them but managing to squeeze in all the ones we'd like to listen to.
And are they becoming more popular at festivals as well in the summer, these sort of early music?
I think they possibly are, yes. I've certainly heard one or two of them at folk festivals recently. It's something that's perhaps catching on, yeah.
So how long does your programme go on for?
We usually start March or April and do one a month through until December. And the one we do in December, the Christmas concert, is always sold out by the middle of the year.
And is that early carols?
Sometimes it is. That was the clock you just heard.
Very old clock.
Yeah. Sometimes it's carols, sometimes it's just medieval Christmas music, but it's always going to be something interesting and what you won't hear anywhere.
Got any
else.
Really big names coming up in the autumn?
Well, as I said, we've got John Tamms. Earlier on, we have the Yetis, which some of you may not have heard of, but they're a big folk group from Yetminster in Dorset. And if you want to hear the sort of thing they play, listen to the Archers on Sunday morning, because they play the theme tune for that.
Can you tell us about your website?
Yeah, we have a website, and you don't have to remember the address. You just have to type Ost and Music. So you type that and music into Google. The Ost Music website will be the first on the list. if you don't know where Ost is, it's just by the Severn Bridge on the English side. Anyway, come along the M5 or along the M4, turn onto the M4 towards Wales, and then on the M48 towards the Severn Bridge, and get off at the junction just before the bridge, which is signposted for Avonmouth. Take the Avonmouth Road, and after a couple of hundred yards, you just turn left into Ost Village, and there's the church.
That was Anthony Page talking to Peter Dobbins at the church in Aust. The bespectacled and wonderfully coiffured one is here, Jeff Sparks. This week's evil T-shirt of choice features Motley Crue jumping in the air. I'm suspecting the photograph did employ the use of a trampoline of some sort. Otherwise, I don't think people so old could jump quite so high, in my own personal opinion. But here he is. What's going on in Bristol?
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On Guy from Dialect Radio. Starting with Friday 8th of May, and Kid Carpet will be performing at Lab, which is at 27 Broad Street in Bristol. Doors open at 9 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance. Also on 8th of May, Fat Man Swings will be performing at the Prom Bar in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. Moving on to Song of the Week, and I feature the Bolsheviks. This is from the recently released album Action Reaction, and this is the track Take Me to the River. We'll be right back. That was the Bolsheviks with Take Me to the River from the album Action Reaction. Now, the Bolsheviks will be in the studio in 2 weeks' time for an interview, so make sure you tune in for that. For more information on them, you can check out myspace.com/BolsheviksUK. Moving on to Saturday 9th of May, and the Broken Family Band will be performing at the Thekla in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. Also on 9th of May, The Remnants, Chains of Hate and From Plan to Progress will all be performing at the Croft in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £2 on the door. And finally on 9th of May, Fab 208 will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is free. On the 10th of May, Phil King will be performing at the Bell in Walcott Street in Bath. The gig starts at 1 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Time for a notice, quick notice here. The Tibet Society in Bristol has sent an email to us here at Dialect Radio about the death sentences passed on Tibetans following last year's uprising. You will have noticed that we have had a slight little Tibetan theme that's been popping up, particularly with Paldun Gyatso, who was interviewed by Anthea Page a couple of weeks ago. On 8th of April this year, the Chinese authorities in Lhasa sentenced 4 Tibetans to death and 1 Tibetan to life imprisonment for their part in last year's uprising in Tibet. Currently, 2 Tibetan women are awaiting a similar harsh verdict from the Chinese authorities. The sentencing of Lobsang, Gyatsan and Loyak to death sentences, Tenzin Punsok and Kiangsok to death sentences with a 2-year suspension, and Dawa Sangu to a life imprisonment term are extremely harsh. Well, that's stating the obvious, isn't it? Really extremely harsh, arbitrary and summary in nature. These verdicts by the Lhasa courts do not even meet the minimal international judicial standards. The Tibetan people continue to live in fear and repression under the Chinese communist regime. The Tibet Society is urging everyone, and this is why I'm reading this, to write a letter of protest against these sentences to Wu Aying, the Chinese justice minister. And I'll spell the gentleman's name, if he is a gentleman. W-U... And the second name is Aying, which you spell A-I-Y-I-N-G. He is the Chinese justice minister. And if you want to know how you can write a letter of protest to him, and the more he gets, the better, email the Tibet Society at Team Tibet Bristol, and that's all one word, teamtibetbristol@gmail.com. And I would urge everybody to do that. That's all from Dialect Radio this week. On a slightly lighter note, I want to read out a little notice here that says The Kick Inside, who are a local Bristol band, truly great, are set to release their first 7-inch single. It's going to be called Oh Vanity. The record will be put out by Oddbox Records on May the 8th, 2009, and the B-side will be It's Always the Quiet Ones. Check out their website, myspace.com/thekickinside, or you can visit the Oddbox Records site to order the single from oddboxrecords.com. And the Kick Inside's next gig is, remind me?
9th of May
at the Mother's Ruin. 9th of May in the evening at the Mother's Ruin. And of course, you can check out the Kick Inside website to check that date once again. Just to remind you, the night walk for the 125 charity in aid of women who work as vulnerable women and prostitutes. Check out justgiving.com/ONE25nightwalk to check out what you can do for that. Studio guests were Keith Donoghue, the Town Clerk of Wales and Somerset, and Jackson Moulding from Ecomotive. Reporters this week were Anthea Page and Tony Gosling, thank you as ever for their efforts, and Malcolm Grieve read the first instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. You can hear more of that next week. Jeff Sparks brought us What's On in Bristol and Around, and the studio engineer was Velis Chuchakuran. In next week's show, Keith Farland will be here to tell us how to make your own cheese and yoghurt. The email address of the Tibet Society, once again, Team Tibet Bristol, that's all one word, teamtibetbristol@gmail.com. Email them for any information about what you can do. And that's about protesting against the recent harsh sentences imposed on the Tibetans involved in the uprising last year. Well, on that rather sober note, goodbye from me, John Peters Coleman, and from all of us here at Dialect Radio. The producer was Anthea Page. She's waving at me going, me! She does an excellent job. Take care of yourselves. Goodbye.